I need everyone's attention. I'm Detective Carter. This is Inspector Lee. All the triads and the ugly women on this side, and all the fine women on this side, right now. Translate.
Yeah.
What is it good for?
Absolutely. Nothing. Listen to me.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus Rush Hour retrospective series.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Don't nobody understand the words that are coming out of your mouth, man.
Hosted by Arnie.
This ain't no democracy. I'm the president, I'm the emperor, I'm the king. I'm Michael Jackson, you Tito.
Jacob.
He's a very dangerous man.
I'm a very dangerous man.
And Stuart.
I'm no punk bitch.
I ain't no punk bitch neither.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
You tell this piece of S word that I will personally F word him up.
Listener discretion is advised.
Why would they not want my help?
Because they don't give a damn about you. They don't like you. I don't like you.
I don't care. I'm here for the girl.
The girl don't like you. Nobody likes you.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Come on, Lee, now. Get your ass up, man. We got work to do.
Good God, y'all. What is it good for?
Absolutely.
Nothing.
Said.
Whoa.
Today we're discussing Rush Hour 2, starring Jackie Chan, Chris Tucker, John Lone, Alan King, Rosalind Sanchez, Harris Yulin, directed by Brett Ratner. This is the now playing co-host who's cute like Snoop, Arnie,
and Stuart.
And this is the host who's always inviting women to sacrifice small goats, Jacob.
Now, you guys may probably breathe a big sigh of relief with what I'm about to tell you. But do you know what movie Brett Ratner walked away from to make Rush Hour 2 fit in his schedule?
Killing of a Chinese Bookie 2?
Yeah, some other John Cassavetes remake. Maybe he was doing Citizen Kane, too. What masterpiece was he going to murder?
Ocean's 11.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, and in some weird ways, this movie has... It's in a casino, at any rate. I could see how he might be interested in the subject matter, but yes... We have a better movie because he did not do that film.
Yeah, Soderbergh stepped in when Ratner stepped away because he didn't want anybody else to direct his baby. Rush Hour was his. The studio was pressing ahead with Rush Hour 2. Ratner could come along or be left behind. In between, he did a film I have not seen, The Family Man with Nick Cage and Taya Leone.
Yeah, I remember hearing unflattering comparisons. It was his It's a Wonderful Life is what I hear. He tried to be Frank Capra.
Oh, no.
Yeah, again, he has pretensions, I guess, but he doesn't seem like a guy. He seems like a frat brother. But then to hear him talk, apparently it was some kind of what if I had never been born kind of scenario, and it didn't get good reviews. He also did direct the pilot to Prison Break, which is a show that ran for a few years and was good until it wasn't.
He's done a lot in television, and I've seen some of those shows. And Family Man, I think I do want to see it. It has Jeremy Piven as a character named Arnie. Could this be the first non-shitty Arnie in cinematic history?
I don't know. Doesn't Jeremy Piven show up in this film?
Yeah, I hope he does better work in Family Man.
Well, Family Man, you might notice some of these names. Don Cheadle, Jeremy Piven, Saul Rubinek... Okay. All people who are going to cameo here.
Yes, I didn't know they were going to be in this film, but it was part of the surprise. There were a few surprises to Rush Hour 2. In fact, I think there were two surprises, happy ones for me, coming back to what everyone heard last week was a movie I really didn't enjoy, but different screenwriter. Hey, we're on much better footing, okay? Yay! All right, yeah, maybe he wrote Speed 2, maybe he wrote Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but hey, it's a different screenwriter than last week. That can only be better.
At least if it's bad, it will be a different kind of bad.
Yeah, and the screenwriter was on the commentary. Like I said, the last one was a spec script that had sat around for a long time. God only knows what the writer thinks of what eventually went up on screen. Here, the writer was involved, and Ratner would call him up and be like, I want to add this scene tomorrow, write it tonight.
Yeah, undesirable situations. But, you know, every screenwriter faces them. And you're right. Sometimes the person that writes the original script gets cut out. But you're saying Ratner, rather than making his own choices about what to do next with the story, kept the same voice that started this project. And that at least is a shout out to consistency, if not complete artistic success.
Tucker certainly was going to come back. This got him a $45 million deal with New Line, $20 million for Rush Hour 2, and already signed $25 million for Rush Hour 3 after $3 million for Rush Hour 1.
Wow. So he never has to work again. That's why we haven't seen him.
Yeah. And I feel like that wasn't even the highlight of his year, because the same year this came out, he was starring, I guess you could call it that, in the new Michael Jackson video for You Rock My World. Have you ever seen that? It's horrifying to behold, because Michael Jackson at this point, his nose is collapsing in. He is very difficult to look at. But Chris Tucker and him are hanging out, and they essentially are buddies, and he gets to live out his MJ fantasy with the King of Pop himself right there.
I have seen it. I don't remember the nose collapsing. The funny thing I'd heard is he told Chris Tucker that when he did the Michael Jackson dance in Rush Hour, he kicked out the wrong leg with the dance. Other than that, it was pretty good.
Yes. So, yes, Tucker has every reason to be happy about coming back. Where was Jackie Chan? I guess you had said he had done Shanghai Noon.
Yeah, he just had come off of Shanghai Noon with Owen Wilson, another big hit for him.
Yeah, he didn't have to do this movie, but obviously they weren't going to make it without him. I don't think they would have brought another Hong Kong star in for the sequel. It has to be Lee again.
And I truthfully believe, like Lethal Weapon, and I think you see this in the outtakes for this movie, Chan and Tucker really like each other, like their characters. I think they have a good rapport, and they like hanging out with Brett Ratner.
You're saying we can see it as evidence in this movie?
Yeah, in the outtakes of this movie, when you see them break script and you see them talk to each other as actors instead of as Lee and Carter, they actually like each other. They like hanging out together, and I think like Lethal Weapon with Gibson and Glover and Donner, here, Ratner and Tucker and Chan have fun together.
I actually picked up on that. Just to preview some of my thoughts, they're not as harsh as last week. I actually did feel like the buddy chemistry is more on solid footing this time around. And I credit some of that maybe to the fact that Jackie Chan has probably worked for the last 3 years on his English, is able to say more dialogue in this film. But yeah, maybe he's also gotten to know Tucker and Ratner in new ways that allows them to collaborate and have more fun and more success.
I don't know. One of the behind the scenes things had Ratner standing right next to Jackie Chan as Jackie Chan is acting. And kind of like me to you, Stuart, when I'm like, wait, say that over because I made a sound. Yeah, he was doing that to Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan would say a line and Ratner would be like, no, say it again. No, say it again. And Jackie Chan just working so hard to enunciate English. His English was still really bad. But he didn't just do Shanghai Noon. What he said is, after every American movie, he never wants to lose his Hong Kong fan base. Mm. He'd go back and do a Hong Kong movie as well. And he did have a two-movie deal signed where I said Tucker's going to get $25 million for Rush Hour 3. They promised Chan distribution rights in Asia for Rush Hour 3.
Mm-hmm. The handover of Hong Kong did not totally kill the film industry there. Yeah, a lot of people had left. But again, we didn't see the repressive crackdown that they did in Tibet. And so, yeah, Hong Kong continued to be a place where, yeah, artists could thrive. And so it doesn't surprise me that Jackie Chan was able to go back and make movies on his own term there.
Yeah, Artie, you're talking about The Accidental Spy. You could skip it.
I wasn't planning on not skipping it.
Does it have a child? I feel like that sounds like Spy Kids.
No, there's no kids in this one. He teams up with kids at one point, but not The Accidental Spy. Just an ordinary guy who becomes a spy.
Okay. Well, yeah, it sounds kind of generic. But what about this movie? Arnie, give him the plot. We'll get into Rush Hour 2.
This movie picks up just a few days after the first film, and LAPD detective James Carter is on vacation in Hong Kong with his new friend, Chief Inspector Lee. But Lee is more interested in working his cases than taking Carter on a tour of Hong Kong dance clubs and massage parlors. Lee's latest case is investigating a bombing at the U.S. consulate. Lee suspects the Triad Gang is involved and goes to question Tan, a Triad leader and Lee's late father's former police partner. So you follow that? It's a little tricky. Tan was Lee's dad's police partner. and he was a triad lead.
At the same time, we're still not sure.
Yeah, it's Griffin all over again.
Yeah.
Tan says he's being set up by a rival triad gang and is shot and seemingly killed by his henchwoman, Hu Li. Due to Lee's personal connection to Tan and the loss of that lead, Lee is pulled off the case and Carter is ordered to return to L.A. Do they deport people so quickly? Last movie, it was Lee, get out of America. And now it's Carter, get out of China.
Except they do get out of China this time. Like, that's a bummer. They're not in China the whole time.
Yeah, I did not remember that. I thought they were. Lee goes with Carter because Carter convinces him they're still following a lead. Billionaire Stephen Rain, played by Alan King. Rain happened to be at Tan's party, and Carter suspects him of being somehow involved with the triad. Back in L.A., while investigating Rain, they're told to back off by Secret Service agent Isabella Molina, played by Rosalind Sanchez. Molina is undercover investigating Rain for money counterfeiting. Lee and Carter follow the money to Las Vegas. Rain owns the Red Dragon Casino and is using it to spread out his counterfeit money and replace it with real currency. Lee is captured by Hu Li and taken to Tan, who is still alive and has been working with Rain on this big plot. And Tan admits he kills Lee's father to cover up his criminal activities. Rain betrays Tan, so Tan kills Rain. And after some fighting, Lee kicks Tan out a window, and Hu Li blows herself up with one of her bombs, and Carter and Lee are safe. And the movie ends with Lee about to fly back to Hong Kong, but Carter is flush with cash he won at the casino, so Lee and Carter instead decide to fly to New York City for a real high-rolling vacation as credits roll.
You're more excited about this writing, Stuart. Okay. Because that plot sounded very convoluted again.
Yeah, and there are a lot of similar beats. I'll just put it that way. I feel like in many ways...
Oh, exactly the same beats.
Yeah, the idea was not to fix what wasn't broken, at least in terms of box office. Rush Hour was a hit. Why would you want to do anything different for the sequel? Except, yeah, Crocodile Dundee 2 style. Now we flip the script and it's Carter in Hong Kong, fish out of water. And frankly, to me, that's more satisfying already. Even if that's the only creative choice that was made, I like that better than making fun of the Chinaman in L.A.
I like it also because it gets some good cinematography of Hong Kong. It feels like a little bit of a travel log, as you've said, in about other movies, Stuart. You're getting to see another place through Carter's eyes. So you feel like you're with Carter exploring this new area. Although I've never gone to a country and immediately walked into a karaoke bar like I owned the place and asked where the whore parlors are.
Have you ever touched a Chinese man's CD?
I have, actually.
I mean, these lines are just not as good. I like never touch a black man's radio, line that I quote all the time. Touching a Chinese man's CD, that sounds dirty, sounds weird.
It does sound a little dirtier.
It doesn't come with the same connotations. I don't know what that would mean or do, but again, it's just a role reversal of the joke last time. We'll get a lot of that. Before we get any of Carter and Lee, though, we should begin in this prologue here where we have another consulate building. No kidnapping this time. Instead, we have a woman, a femme fatale, a Chinese woman in a blonde wig and a black trench coat walking in with a package that, surprise, surprise, ends up being a bomb. I had to go look. When did this movie come out? August 2001.
Ooh.
If it had come out in September like the first one had, I can guarantee you people were crazy after September 11th.
Oh no, yeah. You could not do this.
They would have cut this out of the movie. There would have been no bomb. There would have been no building exploded. I mean, they actually digitally removed the Twin Towers from Zoolander. Like, people had lost their damn minds around this time. And I get it. It was a very stressful time. I hope to never to live through anything like that again. But it was a surprise to me to see a movie from 2001 start with a building exploding, because that event, highly taboo.
What's weird is I saw this in theaters opening weekend. I went to Rush Hour 1 in theaters with a friend of mine, and we both enjoyed it so much. We were back together, even though he didn't live in town, to go see this opening weekend. And yeah, I had no memory of where this correlated to 9/11. At no point in watching this did 9/11 cross my mind that it was a month apart. It's fortunate movies make most of their box office in the first few weeks, isn't it?
Now, I want to just underline something because it was difficult for me, but I think I understand what happened here. ZZ Yang, who is a co-star of the previous year's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, I was excited to see her here because I love that film. She's great in it.
Yeah, I remember her being a much more, I mean, she was feisty, but she was much more of a positive presence. Here, it's interesting. They're playing her as evil. This is her in the beginning, right? Like, they never make a big point of underline that we never actually see her put on these disguises or even know why she is doing this, but she is the mad bomber working, I presume, for Ricky Tan. Ricky Tan is the one essentially bombing the consulate because two people here are investigating him, we're told.
Ricky Tan, who's part of the triads, that's how you know this is a generic action Hong Kong film, because it's always the triads. If you need a gang of bad people, wasn't it the triads in part four of Lethal Weapon?
I don't know.
It's always them.
And that's fine. I mean, I'm fine with it being stereotypical.
I feel like if we're going to call out one for its bare bone, cliched plot, we got that right here.
Oh, no. We can call it out. But I think for one thing, it's a sequel. I'm not expecting it to do more than what it did before. And two, given that we are on foreign soil for many Americans who wouldn't maybe even know what a triad is, it's fine if they don't want to get too complicated. I mean, you just need to know it's the mafia of China. That's all that we need to understand.
Yeah, kind of like the Yakuza is always used when you go to Japan.
Sure.
But I'm going to just say this plot is not that much better strung together than the last one.
No, it's not.
Because if you could tell me why a bombing ties to a counterfeit ring that ties to Don Cheadle's Chinese restaurant that ends up in Vegas.
I love the Don Cheadle stuff, but I don't know how we end up in Vegas. I don't know how this becomes a movie about counterfeiting and having plates to make your own money with special bright red burning ink. It's bizarre where it goes.
Yeah, later on, when they get to Vegas, Lee and Carter are both like, "We're in Vegas?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you're in Vegas? How the hell did any of this happen?"
Well, now that you've said Ratner wanted to make Ocean's 11, it does kind of explain some of that. But I will actually argue a little bit. I don't know if it's better strung together. I actually find this movie easier to watch. I actually feel like it's more connected, and that may come from just the sense that the leads are coming from a place where they're friends now. We see it from the get-go before they were arguing about, are we playing the Beach Boys on the radio. We're going to start with them in the car singing along to California Girls. I think it's a better place for these actors to be. I never bought that they were fighting. I believe that they're friends.
I mean, they are fighting a lot. I didn't remember this taking place directly after Rush Hour 1. They're on the plane. They're ready to go to China to go on vacation. Here they are on vacation. It's been 3 days and Carter hasn't got laid and he's super upset about that because Lee keeps taking up police work.
And just to be clear, the Chinese handoff happened July 1997. Rush Hour took place 3 months later. So we're talking about September, October 1997. Not that it really matters, but just putting it in time frame. This movie comes out 2001, but the events are happening 4 years earlier.
I don't actually believe that, though. I didn't look up the models of the cars and things.
You didn't go to IMDb's goofs?
I do not believe that the technology here is period appropriate.
Oh, probably not, no.
In fact, I would equally argue that Rush Hour 1 took place in 2001 as I would argue this took place in 1997.
Yes, I don't believe that anyone here is a stickler for details. And I don't believe that people were researching what would have been available in Hong Kong in 1997. But Lee gets the call from his captain. I know you're on vacation. I know you'd rather be chasing skirts, but the consulate did get bombed and it is connected to your father's old partner. Really, really confusing connection. Can we all agree? Wouldn't it be nicer if it was just Lee's old partner? Why do we have to have it be his father's partner?
Lee's old partner got shot by Sang in the last film. They dropped that, so it couldn't be his part. I guess he could have another partner.
Yeah, you could. I don't even remember that detail, but the fact that we'll never meet his father, I actually thought we would because they brought up their fathers last time. I actually thought maybe we'd have an older Asian actor come in and do a cameo or something. But it's really hard to not understand that backstory and have it be this tether to the villain.
But last time they bonded over dead fathers who were both law enforcement officers.
I didn't remember that Lee's father was dead. I just remember they were bickering about whose was better.
I think it was a big thing that they were both the children of law enforcement. It was part of what brought them together. And here, we're finding out more about Lee's father. I wouldn't be surprised if Rush Hour 3, we find out more about Carter's dad.
You can say we find out more. I get confused more about family lineage that is all talk and no show. There's no flashbacks. It's not even really important that he is the ex-partner. Like, it really doesn't matter at all. He could just be a triad leader.
It's similar to why you say Soo Young doesn't matter last time. It makes it personal for Lee because it's his father's murderer. You gotta have a personal stake and more than just it's a mission and the consulate was bombed.
Typically, these films are gonna give you a flashback. This is a plot point that has been in many Jackie Chan films, and you always get that flashback. His American film after this, Shanghai Night, you're gonna see his dad, and you're gonna see his dad die, and it's gonna be about going after the guy who killed him. Like, they just copy these films but set them in the Old West for those, but you actually get to see it, and seeing is more powerful than just trying to catch a line here and there in a film.
And it was confusing to me that Lee knew who killed his father 5 years ago and hadn't done anything to bring him to justice. I was like, really? And that the police will actually be asked, they'll call him to tell him this. And then later the Secret Service guy is like, don't get involved. You called me. Like, what do you mean don't get involved? Do you want me in this plot or not? I just find all of this, yes, messy, just like the last time. And I feel like it would have been really easy with lines of dialogue to trim this to be, here's just a Chinese villain and Lee knew him. He killed his old part.
I don't think Lee knows that Tan killed his dad. I think Lee's the only person who doesn't, because I sure as hell know when we're introduced to a triad member who used to be partners with his dad that he murdered him. But it's the big reveal at the end, Lee, I killed your father.
I thought that they said it in lines of dialogue throughout the movie, though. Again, I'm not going to swear to it. I just feel like this movie is not clear about these relationships. It would be actually very helpful for them to ignore all of these things because they don't end up mattering. And what we're here for is, yes, why not have Chris Tucker try and sing another Michael Jackson song to an audience that's not very receptive to it? He's doing karaoke, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, because the guy before him was murdering it.
And I think the audience is pretty receptive. Didn't you notice all the hotties who were dancing around him?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that was about. I don't think it was about his singing, but it was the fact that he was the new guy in the club and everyone else here is triad and doesn't really seem to appreciate that they have any foreigners here. What was supposed to go down here? It ends up just being the first action scene, which is kind of late for this series. It usually starts with action, and now it's taken about 10 minutes before we're going to get a chase up a scaffolding.
Well, the first movie did. It's not like this is part 8 where we have a pattern.
No, yeah, I'm just saying that you usually want to start with a bang, and it has been more like start with some Chris Tucker jokes.
Well, we started with the consulate, but yes, this is the first time we get a fist fight. And I think that Lee was just trying to eavesdrop. Remember, he went to, quote unquote, use the bathroom, followed some suspects into a back room.
He knew this was a triad nightclub where Tan would hang out. So he's trying to, yeah, find some kind of information out.
Okay, so he's just hoping to overhear somebody say something about Ricky Tan. But even though he knows Ricky Tan goes to this massage parlor that they're going to go to next, he really came here because ZZ Yang needs to show us that she's the bad girl now, and they're going to have an okay-ish chase up a bamboo scaffolding.
Yeah, I could skip it. Not impressed.
I wanted them to deal with the heights more. I'm always excited when people dangle and we see real actors dangling.
I mean, ZZ Yang was just, yeah, running up trees and flying.
Yeah.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And this, yeah, they just climb up some scaffolding.
I'm going to just show my hand. I did not like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon at all because I went in hearing it was a martial arts film. I wanted a Jackie Chan film. I got tree ballet that sucked. And so I don't care that that's what she's from. I didn't even remember it. I saw that in theaters.
Oh, that fight she has with Michelle Yao is one of the greatest fights in cinematic history. Like, that weapons fight, it is amazing.
To some, apparently. I'll come down in the middle. I don't think it was one of my favorites, but I thought it was a really good film. And I thought she was very alluring in the film. Here as a bad girl, it's kind of a nice role reversal, but I don't feel like she gets a lot of meat. I kept wondering, does Lee know her because they've had a previous relationship? I kept waiting for more to be there because Chris Tucker's always talking about, you need a girl, and I just thought that they were going to finally give a backstory to Lee and ZZ Yang would play into that. But it just ends up being about dangling off a bamboo pole. And that's all I have to say about it. It was okay-ish. And next we move on to a massage parlor where no one is getting happy endings. It took me forever.
They're in a group room. This is crazy. You got to go to a private room.
I couldn't understand. I have been to Thailand, and when you see fishbowl rooms with girls with ribbons on them, it is not going to be about the transaction of foot massage versus shoulder rub. Like, this is sex trade, and I am very surprised in a PG-13 movie that they go there and then pull back.
That's the whole reason Carter wants to go there.
All right, several things about this scene. First of all, Brett Ratner happily discussed on the commentary how he had to drag his producer to many massage parlors in order to research this, wink, wink.
Wow, okay.
And yeah. Hang on. And then the writer who was doing the commentary with him went, you see those risers with all the women? That's what Brett has in his apartment.
Wow.
So this is all stuff that in hindsight is really ugly, especially when you hear the accusations that he approached attractive women on this and told them that for sexual favors, he'd give them a line in the movie so they could get a SAG card.
Yeah, again, I would like to separate whatever Brett Ratner is as a human being from this movie. It will help me be able to evaluate the movie.
Yeah, unfortunately, I knew the Brett Ratner stuff, and so this is hitting me hard when that woman grabs her breasts and starts playing with them, which I think is pretty risque for a PG-13. But the other thing Brett Ratner said, the last movie was Killing of a Chinese Bookie. You guys laughed at me. What is this movie?
Oh, no. Where are we going?
He views this as...
No.
Wizard of Oz? What? I mean, just going like...
Just rip that Band-Aid off.
Enter the Dragon.
Enter the Dragon.
And so what he was recreating here was the scene in Enter the Dragon where you pick the women and the African-American there picked five women. And
yeah, no, I know what he's recreating.
Uh-huh. Okay. There's no secret contest or island or claws with fur on it, but I guess you can get a little bit of Enter the Dragon out of this. But mostly it sounds like Brett Ratner did a lot of research. And okay, again, my only confusion is I thought they were going there. We see Carter always saying, I want some Mushu, and their talk about romantic past. I'm like, okay, this movie is finally going to get into female dynamics. And I just figured they would both fall in love in this movie. I figured that's where it was going to go. And that one of these girls would be the girl that Chris Tucker would end up with, and ZZ Yang and Jackie Chan would work out their issues.
Oh, whoa. I never thought ZZ Yang.
I would love to watch a movie with Stewart's mindset where you're expecting greatness every time and you're always disappointed.
I don't even think Hu Li and Lee getting together would be greatness. But what I expected here was Chris Tucker was going to be face down in a room alone, thinking he was going to be getting the happiest of endings from five masseuses. And I thought Hu Li would then come in and try to kill him, and it would lead to an action scene. Mm-hmm. I did not expect to see them in a group room legitimately getting a massage.
Yeah, that was a shock.
Yes, it's so weird.
But I will say, I have actually been to places, saunas, and this is a thing. Like, the whole TV layout and all these people in the robes, just in recliners. Like, there are legit places where this is done, and somebody went to them because this felt authentic.
Okay, I believe that there are places like this.
You don't get to pick your girl out before, though.
But do you have risers of women who are playing with their breasts?
Oh, no. The place they were before, the fishbowl room with the girls in the sashes, is a sex club. And now they're in an actual, like, it feels like a Korean spa to me. But that is where they actually see Ricky on his laptop. And for reasons, Carter is feeling emboldened. All of a sudden, Lee is afraid. I think this is significant. Lee goes and runs and hides. And Carter gets up and breaks the laptop and is like, you're only 4 foot tall. I can make fun of you. And this leads to the first really big fight of the movie.
I would say the only big fight in this film.
Perhaps.
It's good, except for that stuff where Jackie Chan's trying to save the artifacts at the end of the last one. This is probably the best stuff we've seen thus far.
Yes.
And again, you talk about a different crew here. It does feel, you complained about cinematography. There's one, they put Lee and Carter in purple robes. Everyone else has blue, so it's easy to tell them apart. Yep. That helps visually. That's a great idea. And then there is one cool in Lee's flipping over chairs and all that. There's like a tracking shot that like follows him. I'm like, oh, that's a really neat shot. I wish we got more of that kind of stuff. But it's just there for a second, but I want to call it out because it impressed me.
Yeah, I actually have been the real naysayer about how none of this action in the last time was anything better than okay. And this is good. It reminded me of the lesser scenes in Police Story is what it reminded me of, where it's just like guys in a room using a waste can in creative ways. And so, yeah, I mean, of course, they're going to have stupid jokes about Asian dick size and whatever. I mean, there's always that patronizing for the American lowbrow comedy, but there is some good Chinese physical acrobatic humor as well.
I like the Jackie Chan stuff a whole lot when he's using the Ottomans and things as weaponry. But I also like that Chris Tucker gets some fights in here. And I like when he and Jackie Chan kind of do this synchronized punching thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun that Chris Tucker isn't completely left out in the cold, while Jackie Chan is obviously the better one here.
Yeah, I want to really sell this. They are better as friends than as enemies. Like, that relationship last movie did not work. I just kind of wish they had a training scene, or that they had more time where you understood Lee had taught Carter some stuff about how to fight. But yes, it's a good scene. It ends with them humiliated, stripped naked, left on a highway, having to go back to the police precinct and being told, stay out of the case. And this is where the bomber pops up again, and nobody is alive from the consulate to identify her. We just know that Carter sees her. Of course, he's going to flirt, and he realizes he's left his passport in the massage parlor and needs to leave the room that will blow up seconds later.
I mean, they left everything. They were kicked out naked.
Yeah, the wallet, the keys, anything.
And frustratingly, I don't think he ever gets back and gets it. Like, like he'll leave this country, but I don't think he has his passport.
I don't understand this sequence at all. They're at the police station. He's like, oh, I gotta go get my passport. I'm gonna leave just as an explosion happens. So Lee assumes Carter is now dead because Carter is trying to find that massage parlor while buying a Chinese suit and a live chicken. I expected something to happen with that chicken. It never went anywhere.
Oh, that lady blows on the chicken's anus. I thought she was offering the chicken up to be, to use the euphemism, Carter's mooshu.
No, but I mean, I've definitely, even in like America here in certain Chinatowns, I've definitely seen people present animals in ways that, are challenging. I don't think that everyone expects their food to be so fresh. So they're just kind of playing off of that. That stuff is not so good. You know what did make me legitimately laugh? I haven't laughed at much of this musical humor. War didn't do anything for me, Arnie. But I have to say, when Jackie Chan's character thinks that Carter is dead, and he goes to that silly, overplayed, puffy Biggie anthem.
Uh-huh.
And then it turns into like this neck dance where, like, at first I'm really sad. And then, like, actually, I kind of like this groove and I can't repress my happiness.
You didn't like it when Chris Tucker did the neck dance in the first one?
Yeah, he's doing Chris Tucker's dance.
Oh, I didn't even understand. Don't tell me that, because now I like it less.
That's why I told you. There's nothing new in this film. It's just, we'll reverse it and...
Oh, I don't like that. I just thought that he was an irrepressible character, and even in his moment of listening to a sad song, he would hear the upbeat to it. But okay, he is also doing the dance that he saw his friend do, and that's a repeated joke.
And come on, you gotta laugh because we all know Carter's alive. This movie does not try to convince us for a moment Carter's dead. We know before the bomb went off that Carter left.
Right.
And so it's funny when you see Lee there, really depressed, almost on tears. He only wanted some mooshu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this, I think you do get a sense that Jackie Chan could be really funny in the scene. Just for, even though he's still in Chris Tucker's thing, I like how Chan does it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I'm saying, is I actually am charmed by what Jackie Chan is doing, and that never happened for me in Rush Hour 1.
And that's the thing with Jackie Chan for me, is yes, he's a great martial artist, and we called that out, but I just like him. I like watching him give performances. I like the characters he plays, which are all it seems to me, from what I've seen, very similar characters, but it's not like he has a lot of dramatic range.
I mean, again, there's a reason in the English dubs they always just call him Jackie.
Yeah, I really do like him as an actor, as a charismatic performer. And so I am enjoying him, and I do think he's getting more to do here in these Hong Kong scenes. Strangely, Carter decides to go suit shopping on his way to the massage parlor, though. So he's wearing a nice gold suit.
He doesn't have his wallet. How did he pay for the suit?
Yeah, you know, I mean, don't ask too much. But yeah, what makes me laugh is when I was in Thailand, like, I couldn't go anywhere without someone being like, suit, sir. Like, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was attacked by, you know, like measuring tape of like, let me get your dimensions. Leave me alone. But it just felt true that they would just get him. That he would just end up buying a suit just felt real here. Like, a joke I wish I did like better, because, well, it feels so relevant now, is we have a Trump impersonator in this storyline that eventually all this action descends on a yacht called the Red Dragon, parked in the harbor, that's owned by an LA real estate mogul named Stephen Rain, who lives in Rain Plaza, and everything is named after him. And I feel like Alan King, the comedian, could be doing a Donald Trump joke, but if it is, it's misted on by atomizer. It's not one with a lot of teeth.
Yeah, I didn't get any Trump out of it. It just played very clunky and awkward. Like, all of a sudden, there's this Stephen Rain, and Carter's dropping some line about how he's a development guy in LA, and I'm like, oh, okay, so that's the real bad guy. That's our Griffin here.
They said he was a little bit of Trump mixed with a couple other characters, real people in the commentary, some Vegas entrepreneurs I didn't know. But yes, Trump was on their mind when they created him. Trump as president was not on their mind when they created him.
No, I think the Trump casino would have been relatively new to the scene in Las Vegas, and he was a new figure there. And so, yes. And he's just someone that the American public had known for over a decade. So if you're making satirical targets, you don't want to do some real estate guy that only other people that know real estate guys in Vegas know. You want to know something that everybody knows. So it was an opportunity to create a character that was funny. And unfortunately, I do feel like in Rush Hour movies, the only people that are really allowed to be funny are our leads. I feel like all the supporting characters are the straight men.
But I think they did a much better job. I mean, this plot and how they get from point A to point B, what they were doing at the massage parlor, all of that is a little threadbare. But they do introduce Rain and Tan so much better than they did Commander Thomas Griffin in the first film. Yeah. At least I know who these people are, and when Tan returns at the end, I go, oh, it's Tan, not who the hell was that guy.
Yeah, but this plot is just as bad, and there's not the action that's winning me over throughout. Like, all Lee does, he just gets called by his commander, hey, go check out this yacht. Okay, I'll go drive to the yacht. Meanwhile, Carter is like, oh, there's Tan just walking down the street. I'll follow him. I'll end up at this yacht. Like, it is all still happenstance and pretty lazy.
Yeah, I don't feel like this new screenwriter insisted on great plotting. And I wonder if it's not in the methods of Ratner. And, you know, sometimes you have a director that, if they like a lot of improvisation, they're like, hey, we need to work this in here. The best screenwriter in the world can only do so much to shape something if you're constantly throwing in new elements. And the whole point is, like, let's just go here because it'll be funny. And so, yeah, they're on a yacht for no discernible reason other than it allows us to finally meet again. Ricky Tan, bringing the connection that Ricky must be working with this American Stephen Rain real estate developer. That we do have, like the last movie, a Western and Eastern villain to partner with our Western and Eastern heroes.
Except they're going to try to trick us here and think Tan gets shot and killed by Huey Lee.
Tan is supposed to be making a plea to Lee. They're trying to set me up and get killed to make Lee even more guilty. His father's dead. Now his father's partner's dead. And the triad's probably done all of it. I, at this point, think that Rain is trying to overthrow the triad with the help of Hu Lee.
Possibly, but here's the thing. Again, it's all about casting. John Lone, who is playing Ricky Tan, was the star of The Last Emperor, Oscar nominated. He was kind of the go-to guy. If they needed an Asian actor in the 90s, they usually got John Lone. And so I figured he had to be coming back, just because why would you get this guy if he was only going to do one scene and fall off a boat? So I wasn't totally fooled. And then, of course, if you're following the cut and paste way they're moving the plot points from Rush Hour 1 to Rush Hour 2, we had a character that, yeah, we thought was gone out of the picture and came back. They're trying to recreate the surprise, but flipped. This time the Asian guy comes back in a way you weren't expecting. ZZ Yang, I mean, is she underserved by all of this double crossing? Should it just all have been about her? Should we forget the idea of East and West and just give the actress that just got an Oscar nomination last year for Crouching Tiger her due and have it be more? Again, I wonder if this couldn't be more about romantic relationships and the boys' relationship to girls.
It's a bromance. It's not a romance. There's no romance in these films.
But Lethal Weapon movies bring in women and they become important and it gives new dimensions to the bromance to see how they deal with their women. It's an opportunity to develop character.
I suppose this could be an artifact of what I know of Brett Ratner, but from what I can tell, Lee doesn't care about women, and Carter cares about women insofar as, who can I hire for Mushu tonight?
Yes, and when you put it in that perspective, it helps explain why we haven't seen those characters deepen. It's because the people at the helm have no interest in seeing another dimension. So, all right, so ZZ Yang is only going to be doing this in this way, and it's too bad, because I feel like she could have had a more fun part here.
Sadly, I wish Hong Kong had had a better part here. I don't even think when I saw this, I knew ZZ Zhang had been in Crouching Tiger. I knew Michelle Yeoh from that, but that was about it. So I'm not paying any attention to her, but I am enjoying this Hong Kong setting. And so when they tell Lee, you're off the case, Carter, you leave the country, I'm thinking they're going to do what they did last time, especially when Lee says, I will drive him to the airport. I'm like, they're not really leaving the country. No, they really leave the country. And sadly, they leave the best part of the movie there.
Agree.
Totally agreed. And again, you know, like, how can you not want to spend more time in this new setting? To go back to LA feels like, well, we've already done that. What more could they uncover there that a million other buddy cop movies haven't already mined? There's nothing left. So this was where things could be fresh. And now we're going back to, eventually we'll get to Vegas. So I guess there is something new there, but it does feel like they're running out of ideas.
I run out of energy. I mean, watching two of these in 2 weeks versus quite a bit apart, when they get back to LA, I feel like we're back in the first film, and I'm not enjoying it as much. I do think these two characters have good chemistry, and I'm laughing when they are spying on Rain and end up seeing Isabella undressing and...
What is the point of the Snoopy tattoo? I thought that was going to come back later. That was going to identify her some way. Did I miss it?
No, I had the exact same note. I kept looking for that Snoopy thing. There's even a Snoopy joke later. And I'm like, all right, something is going on with Snoopy. And if it is, it's too deep for me to find.
Brett Ratner likes Snoopy, but they couldn't get the license. So that's not even Snoopy on her ass.
He just loves Snoopy so much, he's going to put it on some girl's ass in the movie. Okay.
Well, here's the only way that I see that it adds anything is that we are not sure how to feel about Isabella Molina. When we first meet her, she's presented as just a sexy babe at the bar at the yacht. And then we find out that, yeah, she's on the arm of this Trump figure. And now she's getting a package that is from the bomb girl. We think her life is in jeopardy. The boys race to save her, and she ends up being Secret Service. Where are her allegiances? You know, she's working for the bad guys, but is it undercover, or is she actually bad? I think they're trying to build a mystery there.
That's what the tattoo's supposed to tell you. Like, they see that same tattoo on a bad guy or something. I mean, that's supposed to play out some
correct,
way. Like,
correct, yes. Somebody had that idea, and who knows? I'll even say the screenwriter maybe even wrote it, but it didn't end up in the final film. And so it just wasn't the interest of the people making this film to connect those dots.
So you talk about how, yeah, she gets this package, or they think it's a bomb. It's not. Stuart, I have to ask you, we asked with Rush Hour 1, what's the deal with all the explosives? Why are they buying all that C4? Why is there so much focus on blowing up buildings here when it's really about counterfeit money and plates to print it?
Yes. What I realize is that Ratner, and maybe every action director, has an explosion fetish. And it is a way to get an audience to pay attention. If there's been too much talky-talky, you want something to go boom so that everyone can be on board again. I feel like the explosions are just a way of making it more, quote-unquote, exciting. But yes, what they really want to talk about are super dollars and...
Yeah, I don't even understand what that means.
That's a real thing.
Is it?
It is a real thing. And the story they tell about how the U.S. gave an actual plate is true.
Yeah, the Shah of Iran detail felt so outside of the rest of this movie. I was wondering why they said it. It's because it's based in truth. Wow. Yeah. I'm always excited when movies can dig up that kind of stuff. I wish I could believe this movie's more when it was telling me things.
I guess they set up that explosion at the beginning. They say two U.S. translators died. Later, they'll reveal that they were U.S. agents. Now, I know the Secret Service, was originally put together to go after counterfeiters. So maybe it was two Secret Service guys, but it just seems like explosions played such a big part in the first half. And now, nope, it's not about the C4 anymore. It's about the dollar bills.
Yes. And why did she bring her those? Again, I guess we're supposed to be wondering if she's in cahoots with Hu Li or whether she's going to eventually turn them over. There's an obvious tell. Like, we're told that these bills are like nobody, 14 out of 15 people can't tell. All you got to do is hold up a cigarette lighter to it. And if they see a little bit of red, all right, done. Like, the ink burns red. That's a pretty bad tell.
Except how many people are going to burn their own money outside of a rap video?
Yeah, I mean, you just burn the edge, right? Like, you just, you know, not enough to damage the bill.
You can take Scorch money to the bank and they'll replace it.
Yeah, they need to work on that ink thing if it's going to be a super bill.
Well, this is where I feel like we're back in the first one, though, because Isabella is going to ask them to help, but she's really, like the FBI last time, trying to give them a fool's errand so they stay out of her way.
Yeah. Again, we aren't to trust her because as soon as she's like, oh yeah, you guys can help, she picks up the phone and calls somebody and says, yeah, I got rid of them. And they're not help. I mean, like, their idea of helping is to go to the Crenshaw Kitchen Chinese soul food restaurant.
Best part of the film. Love Don Cheadle in this role. Like, I wish this was more of the movie.
It's not the best part of the film, but I do like Don Cheadle. I don't resent it the way that I hated the wild goose chase of the last movie.
What I liked about it, that there is this actual Eats Me West thing with African Americans and Kung Fu. Like, they saw those Bruce Lee films and they wanted to do, I mean, Reed talked about Rudy Ray Moore. You watch the Dolomite films, he wants to be Bruce Lee. Like, talk about the Wu-Tang Clan. They're all about the martial arts films. So this felt exciting. I'm like, oh, okay, they're actually getting something right here. They don't do anything with it, but I just like it as a fun little nod.
Well, it's a cameo. Before they even started shooting at all or anything, Ratner was talking to Cheadle and said, Cheadle, I'd like you to come do a role in Rush Hour 2. And Cheadle's like, I will only do it if I can speak Chinese and fight Jackie Chan. Those were his requirements.
Okay.
And so Ratner went to the writer and said, we need a scene. And this was their first day of shooting where Don Cheadle is going to fight Jackie Chan. And Don Cheadle's really doing those moves. He's keeping up with Jackie Chan.
Okay. I wouldn't have guessed that. I was like, oh, yeah, they cut away and somebody, stunt guy. But okay. Well, then he deserves some props. He obviously went to the gym and worked at that for a little bit. He's obviously a martial arts fan.
Yeah, and I liked seeing him in here. I had no memory of him being in this movie, but to see him there as the soul food Chinese restaurateur, I don't know exactly what information he can give them of use.
Well, yeah, he runs a gambling parlor at the back of his restaurant, and he knows that some of this money is the super bills, and he earmarks the guy that gave it to him, which is one of your favorites, Ernie Reyes Jr.
I'm always happy to see him. He is starting to get unrecognizable as an adult, as I knew him back in his Mutant Ninja Turtle days.
Mm-hmm.
And Surf Ninjas.
But yeah, he's working the front desk at Rain Plaza and basically runs out of the film. He leads him into the back where Lee and Carter become imprisoned in a semi and are driven to Vegas.
and my head is spinning.
Yeah.
How exactly did they get, why were they kidnapped? Why were they taken to Vegas? Why were they put in a semi with statues full of superbills that are supposed to decorate the Red Dragon Casino? So are they going to break the statues open, or are they going to keep piles of superbills around the casino?
Let's just keep walking. It's burning, it smells bad, and we'll never put the flames out. I can't even try. I agree. It is the worst part of the movie. It is the most awkward part of the transition. But if they can do something in Vegas, I guess I'll just ignore it.
And Brett Ratner's next film was Red Dragon. We're at the Red Dragon Casino.
Ugh. I didn't even make that connection. I did realize, for reasons, before they get into the plot, they bust out of the semi, do a little bit of kung fu, and then decide they must go shopping at Versace. So that Jeremy Piven was starting to happen at this point. Entourage was a big show around this time.
I mean, I thought he'd always happened since Say Anything. I mean, he had the show Cupid in the 90s. And
Say Anything?
Yeah, he was one of the friends in Say Anything, and
Cupid failed. Like, I mean, you have a different sense of celebrity. I don't feel like Jeremy Piven was popular until Entourage.
Oh, he loved Jeremy PCU?
Yeah, absolutely.
A failed movie, I was on your radar. I get that. You were already a big fan, but the world had caught up with you, and
I never have seen Entourage. Never an episode.
What? That's crazy.
I've even seen a couple episodes of that.
Yeah, and he's good on the show. But here, basically, we've talked last time about Eddie Murphy and Beverly Hills Cop. Now they're going to recreate Bronson Pinchot's cameo in that movie with the lisping gay man who's going to be all flirty. And that's hilarious.
And this was Jeremy Piven completely ad-libbing. They had real trouble even filming the scene because never once did Jeremy Piven or Chris Tucker ever say the same thing. And Chris Tucker had no idea, just like he didn't know who Chelsea Clinton was. He doesn't know who Jeremy Piven is.
Well,
he thought this was a real gay guy. So when Jeremy Piven goes in for a grab, Chris Tucker got really pissed off.
Okay, Chris, it would be interesting to know what Chris Tucker knows. Like, that's fascinating. Does he know what year it is? He may not. You know, again, he doesn't work very often.
He got $45 million for this movie. He doesn't have to worry about nothing, man.
He can live in his own universe. I get that. But eventually they find their way back to a climax and a plot where it's all about Lee trying to find the counterfeit plates and Chris Tucker Michael Jacksoning it up at the craps table.
Yeah, when Tucker says he's going to cause a diversion, that's like the only thing Chris Tucker would be great for as a police cop, right?
Right.
I mean, go create a diversion. Distract the hell out of everyone so we can go do the real job.
Yeah, which Michael Jackson song are you performing now? Like, he ends up on the table doing some kind of moonwalk and screaming about racism and Lionel Richie and I Have a Dream. I don't even know what, but it is more entertaining. I will say I laugh more at Chris Tucker in this movie than last time. I don't know if he is funnier or if I'm just getting beaten down and getting used to it.
Oh, wow. I can't wait till the Green Arrow for part three from you.
He is funnier with Lionel Richie ain't been black since the Commodores.
And Lee does some kind of stunts here. Like, he ends up like holding himself up into the ceiling. And
that's impressive as hell.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. It's something to keep this movie somewhere in the realm of action, which I feel like it's sorely lacking at this point.
And just detective work mystery. I mean, again, someone just tells Lee, hey, here's where the plates are. Isabella shows up. Go get the plates. They're here. Like, Lee never has to do any police work.
And Stuart, you wanted a romance. I thought one was happening. I thought Isabel and Lee were getting close when they have that dancing scene, and I wondered if there was a romance budding there.
Yeah, I mean, again, I feel like probably in a different version of the script or a more complete version of the script that Brett Ratner drove over and shredded up and took to the strip club, he probably would have had that storyline, and probably, I suspect, something for Carter as well. Both of them should be exploring that side of themselves. It would give them something new to talk about.
And when Tucker's making his distraction, we get our third cameo. I did want to call out Saul Rubinick. We talked about him. I most know him as the film director buying all the coke in True Romance. And he's a character actor. He's done a ton of stuff. He did like a season of Frasier as Daphne's fiance.
Yeah, I don't believe he does as much as Jeremy Piven. Maybe that's a good thing, but I guess you might recognize him. It might feel like a cameo, but it doesn't feel like he gets to play with Chris Tucker in the same way.
No, but at least to me, it was like, oh, it's Saul Rubinek. And I didn't think it was a cameo. I thought it was a job, but it's nice to see him there. And apparently there's some other guy who's a pit boss who's also from that It's a Wonderful Life movie, Family Man, that Ratner did, but I didn't recognize that guy.
Mm. Proof that Brett Ratner is not repulsive to everyone. Some people work with him again, so...
Men.
Yeah, there you go. You're right. You're right. That seems to be the trend there. But eventually, it all comes down to a grenade in the mouth. And Hu Li has taken Lee prisoner, and we have the big reveal at this point. They're walking him into the, I don't know what you want to call this, the CCTV casino room, where you can see everything on the casino floor from this vantage point. And Ricky Tan is still alive and hanging out with Isabella. You know what? Here's where this movie needed to work. If Lee had trusted her with something, we now would think that his life hangs in her hands. You know, like, I feel like you needed to play that up more in order to get more suspense out of this. But instead, it really didn't matter to me whether she was good or bad. I guess that's where it landed for me. It wasn't important that she ended up being a good Secret Service agent. And say what you want about this movie being some kind of remake of Enter the Dragon. What we really get here, once the glass is breaking, is a Temple of Doom. Where is the vial of antidote recreation here, with the detonator to the grenade being kicked around and lots of shenanigans?
And Carter gets everybody out because he started really having a run at the craps table, but he was playing with counterfeit money that he stole earlier, quote unquote, for evidence, and now he's gambling with it, and he flings it around. Everybody leaves so that we just have, and they even close like the metal doors on the casino. Carter and Lee are trapped in there. The security guards were like, fuck those guys. We got the people who aren't pains in the asses out. Let's seal off the building with the bomb in it.
Did you feel like Jackie Chan is doing enough gymnastics here? I mean, I get that it's kind of fun that there's a grenade in his mouth and a detonator that could blow him up. If anything, I feel like Chris Tucker is the one later that gets the battle here with the villainous. And where's Chan? Did he break his back or something? Like, I feel like he just decided he wasn't going to do his usual gymnastics.
He didn't, I don't think, decide anything, but he definitely isn't doing as much here. He did the slide through the banker window.
That was really cool. But again, we're talking about seconds and not minutes.
Yeah, no, there's no big fight here. He's just going to kick Tan out the window. There's not a big climax for him. Even this end stunt, which it looks like it's mostly shot on green screen as him and Carter are falling. Like, it's bad.
Oh my God, that's so bad.
It's so bad.
But I think there's, again, they put the wrong people together, because Lee goes off after Tan, and yes, he does need to avenge his father, I get that, but Carter's there with Hu Li. He's like, Lee, go on, I got this, and Lee's like, you what? Yeah. I got this, and Lee's like, all right, and runs away, but no, I think Lee versus Hu Li with her spears and her weaponry and everything, I don't even exactly, I had to rewind. I'm like, how did Carter knock her out? Oh, she hit herself in the head with something that popped up like a Three Stooges thing.
I think what we're told, is he either had a wad of counterfeit money, or all the things that he'd won from the craps table were in his jacket pocket. And when she stabbed him, she thought she had killed him, but it just hit the wad of money and then it maybe bounced back.
No, I mean, she was poking it into him, pushing him down, thinking
she
killed
him. Where did the thing that hit her come from?
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, it just states that Carter accidentally knocks her out.
No, here's what happens. She has a sword. She pushes Carter into a statue. The statue is holding a spear. When Carter pushes the statue over as he falls, the spear bounces and hits her in the head and knocks her out. Just the worst of happenstance.
Oh, it's like a rake to the face.
Yes,
kind of thing.
Right. Like, that's so fucking dumb.
Well, it could be fun if you had really set it up as a slapstick bit, but yeah, I couldn't even tell you why it happened. She's just suddenly on the ground.
Exactly. I had to rewind. I'm like, what hit her? The spear? the dull end of the spear hit her in the head.
Yeah, a missed opportunity, but this movie series is really great at missing opportunities. I'm not surprised. And meanwhile, Ricky, it's probably not worth digging into this too much, but he's decided to betray the Trump figure by stabbing him because the Rain character was leaving with the plates.
Yeah, I mean, the Rain character decided to betray him first, saying, I'm taking the plates, you're cut out of this.
For reasons that don't matter.
Because of some proverb.
Yeah.
There's no reason, though. There's no reason.
Okay, we're walking on. I don't want to know. I never will know. No one on this show knows. If you know, send us a postcard. I'd love to read it, but I'm not going to spend any more time on it. The point is, the bad guy gets kicked out of the window, and the good guys have to jump out of that same window when the bomb girl comes back one more time to do a suicide explosion.
And yes, the green screen there. I know they say Chan does all his own stunts and it's real stunt work, but this is not real stunt work. This makes Chan look bad.
Yeah, I was surprised. I think of him as having an ethic, and I think of him as literally putting his foot down and saying, I will not be here in 1980s blue screen effects here where they can tell I'm not really dangling out of this building.
Now, I know Tucker had a stuntman who is falling out of the building. I can't tell if it's Chan falling out with Tucker's stuntman. You do see that it is Chan running across the side of a semi-truck, whereas you don't get to see Carter's face because it's Tucker's stuntman as he's bouncing off the side of the semi-truck.
Yeah, even with the first Rush Hour, when he's doing that fall at the end, it's a very far away shot. Like, it could be a stuntman. You're saying he was rigged to stuff, but this doesn't even look like there was a stunt. They just stood in front of a green screen.
There was a wide shot where you see them, and it's obviously practical.
And let me ask, if Jackie Chan isn't doing the kinds of things we expect him to do, is he doing anything else to counterbalance that? Do you feel like if you don't give Jackie Chan an action scene, Jackie Chan doesn't work? Because I think we're supposed to be charmed that he's in love with Isabella.
Not in this film, it doesn't work. I would say something like the Karate Kid remake. You know, he is a sensei in that, but I don't feel like that's really a showcase for his martial arts. But he's actually able to pull out some good dramatic scenes there. So he has stuff to offer. He could offer things besides cool stunts and fights, but this film doesn't showcase any of those other skills, any of that comedy that he does, the charm that he has. I don't feel that ever really shines through to replace the lack of physicality from him.
I think it does. It doesn't fully fill the gap of his lacking his martial arts, but he's still an enjoyable presence. I like the scene where Isabella kisses him at the airport and he walks away with that little smile. The thing is, you tell me he's, what, at this point 58? Yet he still has this little boy smirk, especially during romance scenes.
That's what I'm saying. If they would have made this a romance, they could have played up those strengths that he has with kind of that goofy schoolboy charm that he could pull off. But it's not really that film. It's not a romance. He doesn't have a lady that he's going to fall in love with.
Yeah, I have to believe that that was the calculus that was planned and then removed from this film. There's too much about it for it to not end up having been somebody's idea that got cut.
Except they knew they were doing three when they did this, and I don't think they want to carry Isabella into it no matter what.
Oh, yeah.
They knew three was coming because three's going to be a long time away.
Tucker signed a $45 million deal for two films. 20 for this one, 25 for the next.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm not saying because he falls in love in this movie, it means she specifically has to come back next time. Or maybe so. I mean, Rene Russo was an asset to Lethal Weapon. As the main characters became less charming, she kind of helped.
Yeah, she was great barefoot and pregnant in part four.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of problems there.
Well, she helped in three. That was it.
Yeah, that's really my point. But yeah, I'm not going to miss Isabella here. And it's really just a way of seeing the guys. I guess they're following her to New York and staying together and staying on vacation.
Is that stolen money Carter has? I know he says he had a lucky streak at the craps table, but he pocketed.
Oh, I took it as stolen money. That's those super bills, right?
I actually feel like they've muddied this so much that it can be whatever you're morally comfortable with. He could either have won that. He could be using stolen money. He could be using counterfeit money. I don't know.
Even if he won it, didn't he win it by staking super bills?
Yes. Yes. And part of the ethics of his job is he's not. Yes. Whatever allows you to smile as they head off into the sunset, That's what they want it to be.
Well, what makes me smile is the bloopers where I always remember this one, where Chris Tucker didn't turn off his cell phone. Yeah,
that was legit funny. I'm like, I can't believe that, A, you have your personal phone on you in your costume and you didn't even turn it to silent. Of course people are going to call you. I'd like to have known who ruined the shot.
What's funny, in one of the I think it was Shanghai Nights, it might have been the noon, but Jackie Chan does that during the blooper reel. His phone goes off at one point.
Oh, wow. And here I thought Chris Tucker was just so damn unprofessional. But I do like that he's like, no, I'm not going to let you talk to Jackie. They want to talk to you, Jackie.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, yeah. It was fun.
And then the fact that Chris Tucker not only doesn't know who Chelsea Clinton is, he doesn't know what gefilte fish is.
It really is embarrassing. It's got to be frustrating. How many takes where he's going to flub gefilte fish?
Or call Lee Jackie till Don Cheadle puts him in his place.
Yeah.
So, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Rush Hour 2? Jacob.
I mean, look, this has got the same plot as the first Rush Hour, the same story problems as the first Rush Hour, the same jokes as the first Rush Hour. Is this a case of six of one, half a dozen of the other? Maybe, but my problem is, as a Jackie Chan film, there's not a whole lot of Jackie Chan to enjoy here. There's that massage parlor scene. I think that is the best fight scene, best action scene of this movie. There's a few little other pieces here and there, but it mostly rests there. But yeah, there are jokes that land better here than in the first one. But this just feels like a lesser movie to me because it is so many times repeating itself. So it's just, we're going to have it. Tucker said it the first time, we'll have Jackie say it this time, or vice versa. And I kind of just get bored during this one. It's inoffensive. Like, again, I don't think it's that far off from the first Rush Hour. I just think that one has better action pieces, and so it works better as a Jackie Chan film. This, it loses those. Not as great as just kind of an action comedy with Chris Tucker and Jackie Chan. So that one was a mild recommend. This one's a mild not recommend. But again, they're not that far apart. Just this one, yeah, you could skip it.
Stuart.
I'm going to stay away from Jackson 5 metaphors because I like the Jackson 5, and we all know I don't like buddy cop movies very much. So let's look at different boy bands. Like, can this be Backstreet Boys? Can it be 98 Degrees even? Can I hum the tune? I actually feel like this sequel moves quicker. I actually feel like Tucker is funnier. The two stars are more at ease with each other. They play off each other better. There are things that get short shrift. I do feel like ZZ Zhang is one of them. John Lone isn't a very good villain either. But, you know, again, it's nobody's movies but the stars. They're better here. That's what I think is better. But I hear what you're saying, Jacob. If you are here because you love to see Jackie Chan action star, this does feel lesser. This doesn't feel like it delivers, other than that pretty good spa fight. I really don't feel like there is any other fight in the film that will deliver on Jackie Chan police story era. So if this is 98 Degrees and I like 90s boy bands, if I bought this record, I would probably play it to the end. I would probably say that it will be satisfying for a paying customer. To me, it's a great uptick from the last time, which I thought was a total mess. Is that enough for a Green Arrow? I mean, I didn't really like it. I mean, I think everyone's hearing that I'm grading this on a curve.
Help me understand what the uptick is, because I feel like this is pretty much the same plot, told just as bad.
Told better. That is what I'm arguing.
Marginally, maybe?
I think Tucker's funnier and he plays better with Jackie Chan, and maybe they didn't seem to be making fun of him in the same way. There wasn't so many ethnic slurs that belittled Jackie Chan. So maybe they're subtle differences to you. To me, they greatly improved my mood watching this. I'm not as cranky watching Rush Hour 2. It goes by in a rush, and I'll be kind and say that's a recommend, although if I never saw this movie or any other Rush Hour movie, I'd be completely fine with that.
You got one more to go.
Yeah, I have to do it.
I can't believe it got a recommend. No Bad Boys has done it, although we haven't reviewed 3 as of this recording.
Mm-hmm.
No Lethal Weapon has done it, but Rush Hour 2 is good enough.
If I said it wasn't, I'd be forsaking the giggles that I had. They were small but plentiful.
I'm sure there's an Asian man dick joke that Chris Tucker could make about small but plentiful.
Yes, and he's, I'm sure, would love to do it for $40 million.
I'm kind of agreeing with both of you. Mm. I think that the Hong Kong stuff is the best Rush Hour we've ever seen.
Yes, yes, yes.
The fight in the spa. Honestly, I like Chris Tucker, the way he just attracts Chinese hotties wherever he goes. I found that to be a funny running gag, from the karaoke bar to the massage parlor to everything in Hong Kong is tremendous. But then everything when they leave Hong Kong is worse than Rush Hour 1.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The LA part is worse than the LA in Rush Hour 1.
And I think that the casino stuff is no better than the LA Convention Center stuff.
It's not good. But yeah, I think you're right. I'm holding on to the fact that I genuinely enjoyed being in Hong Kong.
So to me, it's almost a null game. Half is better, half is worse. I recommended the last one. I'm going to recommend this one.
Okay. But neither one are we calling a classic here. Can they fix that? I've never heard the third one being the best. Is there a case for that? Two Miz and then the third one's great?
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, I'll just say I've never even seen this third one. As the Jackie Chan fan, I knew by the time that one came out, he wasn't doing anything good. So I stayed away. So that's going to be a new experience for me.
Well, it is like a Bad Boys for Life situation of like, it's happening way late, right? Like it's a decade later or something, isn't it?
It's in 2007. So 10 years after the first.
But not that late. Okay. It wasn't like 20 years past.
No, 6 years after the second one.
Okay. Well, that's not.
It feels like a long time.
All right. Jackie Chan is not going to look like Martin Lawrence did in that third Bad Boys movie. Okay.
I saw it in theaters. I remember nothing. I remembered the phone call and the casino from this one. I remembered the falling down the banner and the which one y'all kicked me and singing war and don't touch a black man's radio from the first one. I remember nothing of part three. I know I saw it.
I'm wondering where they go to in this one.
Yeah.
For at least half the film, till they come back to LA.
Maybe they go to New York. My guess would be you go to New York.
That's where they're headed at the end of this one, so yeah.
And you have to introduce somebody new. I feel like a relative needs to come in. A sister.
Are we going
to
get a Leo Getz?
A long-lost child. Something. We need a new element to spice it up.
Is Max von Sydow enough of an element?
Whoa, really?
He's got to be the bad guy, right?
Isn't he always?
Yeah. All right, Ming the Merciless, why not?
I mean, he's the same age as Jackie Chan at this point. They can just have an old man fight.
So, donors, thank you for listening. We hope we didn't rush through this too much for you. As we all check how long we recorded.
It's all right. 7-8 minutes is fine.
One more show to go. Thank you for supporting our show. We all greatly appreciate it.
Hear, hear.
Until next time, wipe yourself off, man. You dead.
Now, hold on there. We were just coming by to tell you what a great job you did yesterday. When you come back, there's gonna be an FBI badge waiting for you.
You serious?
Yeah, are you?
I don't know what to say. It's like a dream come true. I got an idea, though. I got an idea. Why don't y'all take that badge and shove it up your ass? All up in your ass. I'm LAPD.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Two officers were shot. One man lost a pinky.
But did nobody die?
You destroyed half a city block.
That block was already messed up.
And you lost a lot of evidence.
You still got a little bit left.
What you did was dangerous and completely against policy. And not only that, you did a good job.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
I'm going to get you the money. I'm going to make sure you get the money and we can spend it together, you know, when you get it, because I don't even really work for them.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Stop lying.
I don't lie.
Tell the truth.
I'm telling the truth.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
What did I just say?
You just ask everybody to pick up their samurai swords and shave your butt.
I said that?
Yes.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
You think that scared me? I'm from Los Angeles. We invented gangs.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
So you got your revenge at the expense of a United States government investigation.
Revenge? What are you talking about, revenge?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Nice working with your sister.
Anytime, brother.
It's similar to why you say that Soo Young?
Soo Young, yeah. It's so young, because she's 11, get it?
Ah.
And ZZ Gang, is she underserved by all of this?
ZZ Yang.
Yeah.
You said gang.
No.
It sounded like gang.
I'll say it, yeah.